Okay, everyone. Now this is the start of the program. So please take your seats if you're still in the hall. We have to start now. Also, this is my cue for the brass quintet. If you are the brass quintet, you may come out and sit on the stage. Please do not mind them. They're just gonna take their positions. I want to thank everybody for taking their Saturday to come out here and be with us. I'm really happy to see some faces here that I recognize, lots of new faces, people I haven't seen in a very long time. You are taking part in something that is truly historic, something that I don't think has ever been done before, a hybrid classical concert political rally. I don't know how this is going to go. Yeah, exactly. And to the people who are watching at home who couldn't be with us, hello to you too. And I think that's all I'll say for our introductions. For anybody who's in the hall who is still coming in, please be quiet. And one very, very, very important thing, if you have a cell phone, turn it off or silent. I don't mind the pictures or videos, but your notifications should be off. So definitely do that. If you have to cough, don't. And I think with that, we can get started with our first musical selection. So thank you all.
Thank you.
I want to welcome the new people who just walked into the room while the music was going on. Thank you for joining us. I want to thank the people at home who are just tuning in as well. Thank you for joining us. People should know this is also an international movement. We have started a process every Friday morning here where we've had over 50 nations come on our calls and participate. Past presidents, ex-elected officials, diplomats of all kinds have joined in on these calls and have started an international movement. And I want you all to know that there is an international audience watching as well at home right now as what we do here. I don't know if people noticed, but that was Diane Sayre in the actual brass section. So, and you know, one of the themes, it's a chorus of peace against the ghouls of war. Diane Sayre is not just a US Senate candidate, she's also a conductor, a trombone player, she's my personal friend, and that's what makes her a statesman, is that she's able to conduct a chorus and also fill the roles that need to be filled, like being a trombonist. And it is my pleasure to introduce my dear friend and US Senate candidate running against Kirsten Gillibrand, Diane Sayre.
Thank you. So before I introduce our first guest, I want to thank all of our guests. And we wanted to actually allow all of you to hear the maximum from the speakers, who are all geniuses in their own way because they are courageous. The people who are here today are people of courage. All of us know that with this horrific war drive that we're in, the censorship is vamping up, and the attempt to silence people. Neither Jose nor I has been invited to a single debate, so I take that as a compliment. And if you want to really feel sick, or maybe it's better than laughing gas, you could listen to the debate between Kirsten Gillibrand and Mike Sapricone, the Democrat and Republican Senate nominees. Neither one of them could give Israel enough weapons or Ukraine enough territory to beat the other one. It was really quite something. So I said that about all of these speakers because while I will introduce the first speaker, we are not going to be running back and forth and introducing everyone else. This is going to flow like a composition, and happily, since our speakers are truth tellers, they're also not egomaniacs, so they don't desire to have long, flowery introductions that are going to prevent them from getting their message out. Their names and affiliation will be on the screen behind us. So first, we will be hearing from Dennis Fritz, who is a former Air Force Command Chief Master Sergeant with 28 years at the Pentagon. He's the director of the Eisenhower Media Group, and he has been on many, many conference calls with myself and Jose, and he said repeatedly that we should use him and his knowledge and his words. And let me be clear, our guests are not here to endorse our campaigns. We just happen to be the only candidates wise enough to listen to them. So with that, I'd like to bring up Dennis Fritz. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for having me here. You know, I've learned three things when it comes to people. One is that you stay out of the way when it's time to eat. You stay out of the way when it's time to go home from a hard day's work. And the third thing is that you make sure that you stay on time when you have a tight schedule, because I don't want Diane and Jose upset at me. And so I'm going to give you three quick points I want to share with you. Speaking of staying out of the way, right now, the United States of America is staying out of the way of peace in Ukraine and Gaza. We should be a force for peace instead of providing weapons of war that could indeed lead to a nuclear war. Think about that for a moment. I'm also going to give you a couple quick points. If our Congress would stand by quietly and say nothing about the killing of innocent women and children, think about your value to our Congress and the current administration. And oh, by the way, as they stand by and say nothing, they're providing the bombs, the finance, and a diplomatic cover. I want you to just let that sink in and think about it for a moment. Now, when we talk about our value to our Congress and administration, it pains me when Bibi Netanyahu was here last in the Washington, D.C. area to give his presentation and address before the Congress, an international war criminal and a civilian killer. He called those Americans that were outside of the Congress as useful idiots of Israel. That's what he called American citizens. But worse than that, our Congress stood up and gave him a standing ovation. Now, out there amongst the folks that was demonstrating against Bibi being there was Larry Wilkerson, who you'll hear from later, myself, another patriot and diplomat, Ann Wright, and many other veterans. Veterans, our Congress spat in our faces on behalf of Bibi Netanyahu. I think we need some more third-party candidates. Our value? Let's just ask Lindsey Graham, the great senator from South Carolina. When asked on Fox News about his concern of his citizens in the state of South Carolina after the Hurricane Helene and the flooding, he quickly turned and said, "I'm more worried about the people of Israel." If you don't believe me, look it up, and in these days, Google it. Think about our American students and professors who have the courage, more than our Congress and current administration. They were demonized by members of Congress for standing up for humanity. Bibi, for decades, has been trying to get us in a war with Iran. Don't believe me? Just go back and look at some of the footage. In the last week, he called his conflict with Iran America's war. "You must end your enemy," as he stated. Well, no, Bibi, it's your enemy. You wanted this war, you got it, but leave us out of it. I wrote a book called Deadly Betrayal, The Truth of Why the United States Invaded Iraq. 4,500 men and women lost their lives on a WMD lie on behalf of Israel. I don't want to see that happen again in Iran on behalf of Bibi Netanyahu. Finally, third parties, I'm praying for you. But whichever major political party loses this election, don't blame Muslim Americans, don't blame Arabs, don't blame black men, don't blame peace-loving Jews or third-party candidates. Blame the Israeli lobby, the Zionist pundits, and your cowardice for not standing up to them. I will end by saying, end these wars and free Palestine. Now let's get this party going.
Okay, we are now going to hear from Angela McArdle. She is the chair of the Libertarian Party and also a great human being. So I think we can just go right to that.
Hi, everyone. My name is Angela McArdle, chair of the National Libertarian Party. I hope you're all having a wonderful conference. So what in the APAC is going on with American politics right now? I'm so grateful that Tulsi Gabbard has decided to work to reform the GOP. I do think we need major reforms all across the political landscape, but in the meantime, the rest of us have got to continue to encourage independent candidates and small parties to lead the charge on pushing the anti-war Overton window, because I still think the two-party system is hopelessly corrupt. APAC, for example, donated $539,746, I think, to various candidates and PACs in 2024, all Democrats and Republicans. Lockheed Martin donated over $4 million in 2024 and spent over $6 million on lobbying in 2024, doubled that in 2023. And while Democrats were their top recipients this election cycle, both parties and their candidates did partake of this literal war chest. In an attempt to save democracy, Dems have kicked Jill Stein off the ballot in several states. She is on 38 or 39 state ballots this year during an election that she's received lots of grassroots and campaign support. My heart goes out to Jill and all the other anti-war candidates who are suffering at the hands of the two-party system. Until we can remove the influence of war profiteers and those hungry for global domination, the Uniparty will continue to push its agenda for global control and wars for empire. It is hopelessly corrupt. I really do think Diane Sayre, Chase Oliver, Jill Stein, and other independent and third-party candidates for having the courage to stand up to the war machine. We need more courageous voices like yours calling for peace, calling to save the lives of the Ukrainians who are conscripted into Biden's proxy war, and calling for the lives of many thousands of innocent Palestinians to be spared. Men, women, children, Muslim and Christian. We are all human beings, and we're all God's children. I hope you have a wonderful conference. Thank you all for standing for peace and standing against the corrupt two-party system, and I hope that Diane and Jose have an excellent home stretch to their campaigns. God bless you all.
And now we'll be hearing from Dr. Mark Perlmutter. He introduces himself. He was one of the doctors who was in Gaza for 3 weeks. He was a Jewish American doctor from Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And I have had the pleasure and the privilege to be able to take him around New York City, getting him to his various events. But I'll let him do the rest of the talking. So if we can get to Dr. Mark Perlmutter.
Hi, this is Mark Perlmutter. I'm an orthopedic hand surgeon from North Carolina, and I served in Gaza between March and April of this year. We saw four different types of injuries specifically. Bomb blast injuries, including the crushing buildings that buried many people alive and also shredded a lot of women and children mostly. We saw burns, largely emanating from these blasts. And we saw two specific types of shrapnel injuries. One was a classic high-velocity bullet injuries from snipers, and I said on multiple social media platforms that I've had several children that I saw shot twice, and that just doesn't happen by accident. The other unique form, and the most rare form, were very small tungsten bullets, smaller than a pencil eraser, but largely the same shape, about maybe a third to half that size. They're made out of tungsten. They surrounded a bomb that exploded, very indiscriminate when it goes off. It shoots out into every possible direction in 360 degrees circumference. And these little tungsten pellets fly at such an impressively high velocity that they enter the skin and exit the other side of a limb with almost no visible wound. But the tissue on the inside is purely vaporized. Bone has so many fracture fragments that they're impossible to fix. Muscle is turned to jello, arteries and nerves are thoroughly destroyed, and almost every injury that this cause requires an amputation. This is similar to the pledge it said Israel used in the past that were found based on moral grounds and the laws of war illegal and were banned, and they should be banned again.
Hello, everybody. Wow. Hey there. Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. This room is far too beautiful for what I'm about to say. No, don't take for granted the significance of this gathering today. We are here in support of the only two anti-war and anti-genocide candidates with their own ballot line in all of New York State. That's a fact. And we are, of course, 10 days out from Election Day, which means that the candidates are making their closing arguments as the vote is set for November 5th. So genocide candidate number one, Donald Trump, was on the Joe Rogan Experience last night making his closing pitch to the manosphere. And boy, did that go over big. Did you guys see that? Were you online last night? You saw that blew up. That was everywhere. That was more viral than the Kim Kardashian sex tape. And with bigger tits, better makeup, and longer stamina. 3 hours. Wow. Did you guys see the part where Rogan asked to see the scar on Trump's ear? That was hot, wasn't it? I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. I don't think I should have to be the first person to say it, but, well, not that there's anything wrong with that, if you know what I mean. But genocide candidate number two, Kamala Harris, was in Houston with Beyonce last night. Anybody see that one? Very few people did. Trump on Rogan did much better. Much, much, much better. It was a much huger show. And she was making her pitch not to Joe Rogan's manosphere audience, but she was making her pitch to women voters with a big address on abortion. That's right. You know, Democrats, I have to say, between abortion and genocide, really leaning pretty hard into the baby killing this year, are they not? I mean, it's a little much. Don't get me wrong, look, I'm pro-choice and all. But is there anything in the Democrats' platform that does not involve the mangling of defenseless children? I'd love to hear it. You don't get much information from Kamala nowadays. Did you read the new Thomas Friedman op-ed? He's really going ham on babies. It's called, "Hey, Snugglebug, suck on this." Now, of course, to be fair, Kamala's base of suburban women don't really see abortion in that light. They'd argue they're not just killing babies. We're not just killing babies. We think of it as we're checking their privilege. And Kamala isn't really pro-genocide. She just supports Israel's right to choose. Many feel that all Palestinian life is sacred, but Zionists are steadfast in their belief that life, in fact, begins at circumcision, and they therefore have the right to control their own Arab bodies. And Kamala supports them. She's so into genocide, in fact, that her husband toured the Rust Belt with Jose Vega's opponents just last week, holding events to reassure voters of Kamala's commitment to Israel. I see somebody with an RBN sweatshirt in the audience. Our friend Nick Cruz got a little pushback when he joked that Kamala married her AIPAC handler, but given the events of last week, it does appear he was onto something. And so when you look at Kamala's career trajectory, she got her first big break in politics when she dated Willie Brown. She ties the knot with Doug Emhoff, becomes senator and then vice president. And then she campaigns for the presidency on a platform of abortion and genocide. Her political career is one long game of fuck, marry, kill. Thank you. So while Trump is courting the incels and Kamala is rallying the girl bosses, our closing argument here is a peace rally. What do you know? Third parties are often dismissed as quixotic efforts, but our event here today is far more serious and meaningful than anything Trump or Harris will say over the next 10 days. Jose Vega, Diane Sayre, give me hope in hopeless times. I am so proud of them and so proud of all of you for your disciplined commitment to peace and justice and for being here today. It's an honor to be here with you. Thank you very much.
It was in my contract, I would have a milk crate to stand on. Having a Sunday brunch at Sylvia's with Jose recently, as we munched on chicken and waffles surrounded by framed photos of several generations of Harlem luminaries, I raised the question that was really on my mind after a recent trip to Greece. Knowing the relentless humanism of Jose and the LaRouche movement and its admiration for classical civilization, I asked him how he reconciled that with the brutal forms of slavery practiced by the ancients. He proceeded to answer by quoting Plato from memory and at length. And I thought how odd it is that this guy from the South Bronx is one of the country's few existing products of a classical education. Not the neocon kind they talk about at Hillsdale, or the self-serving so-called anti-woke kind they teach at Zionist psychopath Barry Weiss's University of Austin, or whatever it is that Jordan Two-Face Peterson is hawking to his gullible and desperate online fan base, but the real kind, the kind that keeps AOC up nights, reliving her many encounters with Jose as he plays the part of her lost principles. Long before the analysis of why civilizations fail became a cottage industry for both publishers and online creators, the 14th century Muslim scholar Ibn Khaldun ventured a guess in his classic history, The Muqaddima. He hypothesized that more than wealth, more than land, more than the system of government, it was Asabiya that determined the destiny of nations and empires. This could be roughly translated as unity of purpose. According to Khaldun, the thing that allows 300 warriors to hold a mountain pass against tens of thousands, or a coalition of nomadic Mongolian horsemen to conquer the civilized world, or a collection of inexperienced local militias to defeat the British Empire at the height of its power, is not rooted in material resources, tactical advantages, or social structure alone. If they were, we'd still be suffering under the cruel yoke of British cuisine. It is Asabiya that makes all the difference. So if we ask why a nation that has achieved incredible things, things that seemed impossible at the time, finds itself so spiritually, intellectually, and morally bankrupt that it can no longer fix its roads and bridges, provide health care to its people, or stop its own client state from committing a genocide, if we ask how we became a place where a common prostitute like Richie Torres could even stand for office, much less win one, if we ask why we can't seem to do anything right anymore when we once conquered far greater challenges than we face today with far less resources, the answer, according to Ibn Khaldun, is that we have lost our Asabiya. We have lost our sense of common purpose. And this, I think, is by design. We have been broken down and set against each other so thoroughly that there are many who are made reflexively uncomfortable by any characterization of the American experiment in any but the most negative terms. Some would say this relentless negativity is a necessary corrective to two centuries of cowboys and Indians and Song of the South distortions. Fair enough. But we drove past the balance exit on the revisionist history highway quite some time ago, and we're now well into a self-flagellation that hurts us all. Why? Why are we being encouraged to hate ourselves and each other? Who wants us to lose our sense of ourselves as one people? We should approach this mystery as detectives often do with a simple question. Qui bono? Who benefits? Well, if you've spent the past 50 years extracting wealth from the lower classes, and then when they ran out of cash, moving on to the middle classes, and with them going broke now too, your insatiable greed is finally catching up to the upper middle class, so that pretty soon the circumstances are going to become downright medieval, with a cyber-landed gentry living off the rents and digital crop shares of the great mass of unwashed toiling poors, there's only one thing you have to fear, the people finding common cause, Asabiya, or as the left calls it, solidarity. Jose and Diane are among the few activists I know who haven't walked into this trap of hating the country they are trying to represent, and who understand that we can never overcome the worst parts of our legacy without finding what is best in us, hope, optimism, idealism, inventiveness, charity, self-reliance, suspicion of elites, and a willingness to break with tradition in order to find that rarest of things, something new under the sun. If we are going to redeem the ugliest parts of our history, if we are going to make all the senseless pain we have inflicted on one another and on ourselves mean anything, it will be as Americans, creating a new world with American features. In order to get there, we need a new kind of leader that can reconcile us with our past and use its lessons to create a better, fairer, more equitable, humane, and prosperous future in which we live in peace with all people and finally, at long last, with ourselves. Jose and Diane are those kinds of leaders, and that's why we need to do all we can to elevate their voices in this race and in the years to come.
Hello. In an article written in August 1971, Nixon pulls the plug. Lyndon LaRouche forecast that the policies announced by Nixon on August 15th meant the end of the 1944 Bretton Woods Agreement. He warned that it would be replaced by an austerity regime modeled on that imposed in Germany by Hjalmar Schacht, Hitler's Minister of Finance, who was placed in that position by the head of the Bank of England, Sir Montague Norman. LaRouche's forecast has proven to be accurate, as we are now at the end of a more than 50-year arc of a global paradigm of parasitical looting, administered by the International Monetary Fund and backed by the military force of the United States and NATO. As this transformation was underway, LaRouche offered an alternative. In June 1975, his proposal was published in a pamphlet, How the International Development Bank Will Work. As the economic degradation introduced by the Nixon paradigm shift deepened, LaRouche and his wife, Helga Zepp LaRouche, engaged in an organizing campaign which took them all over the world, promoting his idea of multilateral economic cooperation for mutual development, based on his concept of physical economy, of a system of national credit issued by sovereign nations to produce real physical wealth, not phony monetary valuation and debt. It is this concept which is being worked out by the BRICS nations at their recent summit in Kazan, Russia. The attempt to defeat LaRouche by slander and political persecution has failed. And after his passing in February 2019, it has been kept alive by his wife, Helga Zepp LaRouche, who has participated in hundreds of events and conferences since 1975, from Moscow to Mumbai, from Peru to Shanghai. And she is known in China as the Silk Road Lady. So when the media reports that the idea of the BRICS comes from Jim O'Neill of Goldman Sachs, you should recognize this is a sign of desperation. To divert the potential of the BRICS into a monetarist scheme to protect the bankrupt unipolar order. Mrs. LaRouche initiated the International Peace Coalition more than a year ago to provide an alternative to war and genocide, and drafted the Fundamental Principles as a discussion paper to provide an historical and philosophical approach to durable peace through a transition to a new security and development architecture. It is my honor and great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Helga Zepp LaRouche, who will address us after our next musical offering. We now hear From Darkness to Light, sung by Everett Suttle.
and humanity. The United States of America were once considered all over the world as a beacon of hope and temple of liberty. But most Americans today are probably not aware that the United States has become the most feared country in the world because it tries to remain the world hegemon in an unipolar world at a moment when the world has long become a multipolar world. There are presently two regional wars in Ukraine and in Southwest Asia, which are threatening each to escalate into a regional and even a global nuclear war. If that happens, it will be followed by a global nuclear winter and all life on Earth will disappear. But there are also epochal changes going on worldwide. The BRICS countries have just expanded to 22 countries, representing 4.6 billion people, and with that, 57% of the world population. These nations of the global south are already the global majority, and they are determined to end the period of 500 years of colonialism by building a new world economic system which will allow them to industrialize and overcome poverty and underdevelopment. They are building a great new development bank of the global south, a new investment platform, a new BRICS grain exchange, and other institutions which will help them to grow. It is the most urgent task for re-establishing world peace that the United States supports this effort. We must remember that the American War of Independence was the first anti-colonial war in history by establishing independence of America from the British Empire. In that spirit, the United States must now support the effort to establish a new, more just and equitable world economic order. If the United States would take a cooperative attitude to this emerging system and even become a part of it, virtually all problems in the world would become manageable and could be overcome. The United States is often called a melting pot, meaning that people from all over the world have immigrated to the United States to find a better life. What is now necessary is that the United States cooperates with the 22 countries of the BRICS and all other countries of the global majority, that their countries can also build up to be prosperous middle-income countries where people want to stay because it is their home. If the United States and European nations would do that, the enormous refugee crisis in the world could be solved in a human way. The migrant crisis would disappear. People from these countries would not risk their life only to drown in the Mediterranean or die on their flights throughout Central America in order to reach the wall at the US-Mexican border. If we want to avoid that the world and all human life on Earth is destroyed in a global thermonuclear war, then we have to learn the lesson of the Peace of Westphalia, which ended 150 years of religious warfare in Europe, because the warfaring parties realized that there would probably be nobody left alive to enjoy the victory, since all would be dead if the fighting continues. How much more is that true in the age of nuclear weapons? Let us therefore create a new international security and development architecture which takes into account the interests of every country on the planet and build an indivisible community of security. Let us stop wasting valuable resources by waging war in countless ways and use these resources instead to rebuild America, to rebuild the infrastructure of the cities and countryside, build modern transport systems, improve education and health care, and invest in all the projects of the common good. America has lost its way. The violence, school shooting, drug addiction have to stop. Let us replace hatred and aggression with love, and care for humanity, for the people in the United States at home, but let us also mobilize compassion for humanity as a whole. Never before in history has humanity been tested so profoundly for our moral fitness to survive as now. Let us mobilize within ourselves our innate goodness, that capacity for infinite love of mankind, which will enable us to pass this test positively. Let's replace confrontation with cooperation. Let us finally establish a true peace order worthy of the human species.
Good afternoon. So just talk a little bit about BRICS. I'm sure everyone here is familiar with it. We recently had the meeting in Kazan, Russia, and a couple of things of consequence happened there. One of the things that happened of consequence is that India and China, they've had a very long border dispute, and they were able to meet on the sidelines, and they were able to come to somewhat of an agreement. To turn the volume down a bit on that. Now, there's been a lot of discussions that meant full rapprochement. In talking to people that I know that are more familiar with the situation, what they say is it's a start, that they didn't cure the disease, but they have got a good start on it. And interestingly enough, which made me reflect on the United States, what some of the people who are working for peace in India say, one of the things that they have to overcome is that the Indian government has been putting out a lot of anti-China propaganda. So they're going to have problems turning their people around, and they're going to kind of have to explain to them, well, yeah, we've been putting out a lot of anti-China propaganda, but maybe it's time to go in another direction. And they've created an environment where they're going to get pushback from their own public now that they want to go into a different direction. And that's something that we can take note of here. I think something that is very of great consequence here, if I can find it. There was a depiction of a BRICS banknote. A lot of people may have saw that on the internet. That particular note, it wasn't real. It was a depiction of a note, and they're not necessarily planning on doing a note. That was representative, and the creator, the designer of that note, spoke of it this way, and I think it's important to understand what he's saying. He said, I believe that when he talked about, here's what he said, the depiction of BRICS member states' totem animals on the 2000 BRICS banknote also holds a great meaning, he points out. I believe that BRICS is a Noah's Ark of sorts, meant to save humanity from something terrible that rapidly approaches. Which goes to show that they understand this is not just about economics. Everyone looks at BRICS as this is just about economics, but it's not just about economics, because one of the things that's moving the U.S. empire towards violence, towards war, is economic deterioration. And I think we have to take into account that aspect of geopolitics in the work we're doing and in our discussion today. Here's why. We talk to a lot of friends who are anti-war when it comes to BRICS, and there's a great fear. And the fear is the dollar is going to collapse. I've got a pension, I've got Social Security, I've got whatever, and the dollar is going to collapse. And we have people that mean well, but they have a fear that things that are happening to create a multipolar world are going to have such a negative effect on us that maybe they should try to save the system. You know, people come, we've got to save the system. We've got to do something. We've got to stop Trump. Things are going to come apart, right? And I always say, you got the wrong guy. I am not the cure. I'm the disease. I do not believe that it's in the best interest of humanity or that humanity can survive with a hegemonic notion in Washington, D.C., because economics is the driving force behind war. And what we're doing today, I think, and what we're the work we're doing to support Diane and to support Jose are the kinds of things that can cause us, that can help us to avoid such a calamity. If in fact we maintain course and speed, the hegemonic course and speed that we're on, certainly the BRICS nations, the multipolar world, is a reaction to U.S. hegemony. It's a reaction to the U.S. going around the world, stealing people's stuff. I always say Americans think they're on a luxury liner, they're on a pirate ship, the Jolly Roger. So, so what's important is that we find a way to replace the leadership with people such as Jose and Diane, who can steer the ship in a direction that aligns us with other countries rather than in opposition to other countries, that doesn't see BRICS as something that we have to fight, that we have to push back and stop. It sees it as a positive force for the world. There is no need for them to destroy the dollar. I don't think that's their plan, but I think if the U.S. continues on its hegemonic mission, it is the natural consequences of things that will happen because everyone will have to run from the dollar. But imagine if we were to get a new group of leaders that said, we're going to get rid of these sanctions. We're going to stop sanctioning everybody. We're going to stop threatening everybody. There would not be the need for BRICS to be in opposition to us. We could align with other countries. We could do deals with other countries. We could work. We could reindustrialize. And we could do the things that we need to do in alignment with our brothers and sisters throughout the world. So I didn't just want to come out here and just say, well, this is what BRICS is about. I think it's critical to deal with the fear, anxiety, and apprehension that people have about our economic future, not just about our military future, which, of course, is critical, and that has to be first and foremost because we have to stop nuclear war. I think that we have to not just support Diane and Jose, but we have to support their mission, and that is to make a change. We look at what we have now, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, and we understand that, yeah, are they different versions of the same thing? Yes. And let me add this. And the discussion of reindustrialization, when Donald Trump or whoever says, I'm going to bring back the good jobs, I'm going to bring, all they're saying is, I'm going to go back to the 1950s and 60s when we had industry. But let's not forget, what was going on then? We were overthrowing governments. Why? We were overthrowing governments. The United Fruit Company, you all, people here all know what was going on. We were here being bribed as workers. So our lifestyle was kind of good. So we turned our head and pretended that we didn't see what our government was doing that was driving our economy and keeping it fairly stable. But if we go back to that, we're going to be on a path, right? It would be go back to that if we could, which we can't. But if we could, it would only bring us back here again. So what we need to do is support Jose, support Diane, support, well, a lot of people say third party candidates. I'd be happy with a second party right now. But the most important thing is today that we remember what this is about. We have a good discussion. We enjoy ourselves. We meet other people. We exchange phone numbers and email address. I always say that's very important. Whenever we have events like this, we have to remember that this is a beginning. This is a jump off point. Exchange information. Find out who's online. Find out who's supporting what. Meet the people around you so they can we can work together, then that we can expand our movement to make a change. And I believe if we continue to support these kind of candidates and we continue to grow our movement, that there is a way out of this mess. Thank you.
God Almighty over me.
Hallelujah.
thank you very much. It's an honor and privilege to be here with you today. I never would have thought that I'd be walking up on stage after hearing a chorus dedicated to being against the ghouls of war. It's a good thing to be against, by the way, but I'm sort of what they're singing against, if you take a look at my background. I am the living personification of a ghoul of war. That's who I am. I've struggled with it my entire life. It's like, like an addiction. And I admit, I'm addicted to war. I grew up with war. It was part of my adult life. That's how I defined myself for so many years. And it's an ingrained part of who I am, and it's something that I have to recognize as I deal with the world it is today. But I don't think Diane and Jose invited me up here to glorify war, just the opposite. But you can't appreciate peace unless you understand what the consequences of failing to achieve peace are. And the consequences of failing to achieve peace is war, is death, it's destruction. No, the song that should have brought me up here is the song that played in my mind when I went to war for my country. It was AC/DC, Thunderstruck. No offense, guys. You guys are awesome. But Thunderstruck is the song of war. It's a song I listened to. It came out in September 1990 as we were building up this move to go into the Middle East to take on Saddam Hussein for invading Kuwait. Thunderstruck. When I was assigned to the U.S. Central Command in Riyadh, one of the jobs I had was to hunt down Iraqi Scud missiles, and I would go down to the combat camera guys who had all the videotape of the F-15s, A-10s, F-16s, as they were bombing suspected Scud sites. And I'd clip them together. I was a battle damage assessment officer at the time, but I'd play them to the soundtrack of Thunderstruck. It was pretty cool. Watch, because you see the video of the thing. And, you know, in war, it's not like Hollywood, guys. As the plane's coming in on the target, the video's a little grainy. It's not very much in focus. The resolution isn't great. But you see a white blob down there. And you go, okay, that's it. And then weapon release, boom, Thunderstruck. It was awesome. It was so awesome that I, a Marine, couldn't stand being behind a desk the entire war. No, I had to get into it, guys. This was my moment in time. This is my Lieutenant Dan moment. You know what I'm talking about. Forrest Gump, meant to die for your country. Here I was, safe behind a desk. All I had to do was look at pictures and play rock and roll music, and my war would go by. But no, I had to be in the middle of it because I was a Marine. And so I put in a request to go look at some of these destroyed sites. I said, we need to get the guy on the ground to look at it to see what it is we're destroying so we could determine if it's real or if it's not real. And if it's not real, why we're bombing it. And if it's real, how can we bomb it better? And they agreed. They put me in touch with a SEAL team. You guys know the SEALs, don't you? America's finest, or so they claim. as a Marine, I'll never give them credit for that. But these guys operate what are called fast attack vehicles. They would fly into there. Their job was to rescue pilots. But I wanted to get them to put me in so I could take a look at the debris. They were hesitant at first, but eventually I won them over. I was going to war, my lifelong dream. And we practiced for it. We did our missions. We trained up. And the night we were in isolation, and the night we were going to launch, I'm going to war, we get the phone call. Stand down. Somebody take a look at one of those videos that I used to nominate the target. And they had higher resolution imagery look at it. That white blob on the ground that I was going to go and inspect whether or not it was destroyed missiles turned out to be a Bedouin tent. And all we were going to find inside was a family of about 16 to 20 Bedouin and their sheep. Thunderstruck. Now, I was disappointed. Not for the reasons you might think I should be. Man, we killed some Bedouins. I was disappointed because I wasn't going to war. And I sat out that night staring up at the stars feeling sorry for myself. I had an Australian liaison officer next to me. And we were staring up. It was a beautiful night. Stars are there. And I just started projecting myself out because I was really depressed. I was fundamentally depressed. I wasn't going to war. Thunderstruck. But as I pulled out, I realized, wait a minute, I sucked myself into the sky. You guys have heard about when the American astronauts went to the moon and they looked back on Earth and they saw the blue marble and they were just amazed. They had a whole new perspective. It's called the overview effect. Anybody that's gone to outer space has suffered the overview effect. I say suffered, I think it's a blessing, because it allows you to realize how fragile life is. And that night I had the overview effect. I went up and I realized that the airbase I was on was really just part of a big piece of desert. There was part of an even bigger piece of desert. There was part of a segment of a globe that was round, and the further out I got, the smaller the globe got, and the less significant this war became. Not just less significant, but irrelevant. And not just irrelevant, but totally unnecessary. Why the hell was I so focused on going out and killing Iraqi scuds? Life meant so much more. So much more. And I had one of those moments of clarity where I didn't want to go to war anymore. I wanted this war to be over. I wanted to go home. Next morning, I got up, knocked at my cubicle, and some guys with long hair, mustaches, said, "Hey, you the guy looking for scuds?" I said, "Yeah." They brought me in to a room. They showed me some videotape. I said, "My God, that's a scud decoy." They said, "Yes." I said, "Who did this?" They said, "We can't tell you, but come with us." And they introduced me to a new group of people who were out hunting scuds. Long story short is, I got sent to a different base in Saudi Arabia, and now I'm going back to war. And I'm excited by it again. My God, I'm going to go to war. I get to do it. I get to live my lifelong dream. Now, I was very aggressive about this, too aggressive. General Schwarzkopf, who was the commander, found out that I was trying to be inserted into Western Iraq to capture this scud decoy and bring it back, and he had me arrested. And, had me arrested and had me flown back to Riyadh, where I was to stand charges. They dropped the charges because they realized I wasn't just a young Marine captain trying to go to war, as all young Marine captains are wont to do. But I think back, you know, I fought real hard. I met with the Delta guys, the Delta Force, I just gave away a secret here, and we planned the operation. I met with the Task Force 160 guys, they're the helicopter guys. We had the whole mission planned out. We're gonna fly in, Delta was gonna secure the LZ, I was gonna go out, help strap it up, bring it up underneath a C8 or MH-47, and we're gonna fly it back out. Wow, thunderstruck. Later, a couple years, I was a UN weapons inspector in Iraq, and we were talking to the Iraqis responsible for Scud missiles and such. And I got to interview a general. Interviews, more like an interrogation, a general and some of his officers. And we were talking about this period of time. And I mentioned that, you know, we were actually going to capture one of these. And he said, "Really? Where?" And I pointed on the map. He said, "When were you going to do that?" And I told him the date. And they brought out the documents. They had prepared an ambush for us that night. Had we flown in that night, I wouldn't be here. I'd probably be dead, because they were waiting for us. It was an act of God to get the general pissed off at me so much that he arrested me and canceled the mission. But had we gone forward with the mission, I'd be dead. And so a bunch of other Americans, thunderstruck. And I think back on that. Was it divine intervention? I don't know. But I do realize that that moment of overview, when I sat back and I looked at the world, I think maybe that opened the door into my black heart for somebody to look down and say, that's a soul that could be redeemed. That's a soul where there's some hope. That's a soul I can do something with. So he let me live. And ever since then, I've been trying to redeem my past, my dark past, thunderstruck. I'm here today because of people like Diane Serre and Jose Vega, people like you who are here to listen to them, to support them, people like you who sing the songs of peace, people like all of us who cherish life. We should all experience the overview. Take a moment, sit back, look at the world from beyond and understand how fragile it is and how utterly important it is for all of us to work so hard with all of our might to preserve whatever power that may be above there has blessed us with enjoying. I want to thank you again for coming out today. Thank you for supporting Diane, for supporting Jose. Thank you for being who you are. Thank you for serving peace. Thunderstruck.
We all need someone to handle the mic for us. I'm going to give you two parts. The first part is a little history, and the second part is screaming current events. History. There have been hundreds of empires in the 5,000 years of human history we know something about. In the 3000, we know a great deal about, with approaching modernity teaching us even more. There have been hundreds. All of them are gone. Every one of them. Every single one of them. The Persian, the Eastern and Western Roman, the Mongol, the Mogul, the Ottoman, the Third Reich of Adolf Hitler. Even the empire upon whom it was said the sun never set, the British Empire, gone. Look at Britain today, Washington's poodle, if that. The one distinguishing feature of the current empire, your empire, America, for that is surely what we are, is we invented the means that no other empire in human history has ever had at its beck and call to extinguish human life. If you saw the film Oppenheimer, you know how we did it. It's a pretty good film, pretty accurate film. You know how we did it. That alone makes us unique, horribly unique, perhaps. Part two, the screamingly current events. 2 a.m. this morning, I get up, my phone just buzzed, I look at it. It's Nima Alkhurshid. You may know him from a show called Dialogue Works. He broadcasts from a little village in Brazil, south of Sao Paulo. He's Iranian by birth, but he's a Brazilian citizen now, and Dialogue Works is a pretty good show. Well, he's already working, and the time zone is the same for us and him. He's already working on the ongoing Israeli attack on Iran. Only he's working on it not from MSNBC or CNN or any polluted propagandistic organ in the American empire. He's working on it from the point of view of a journalist. And he's talking to people and he's talking to me and we're texting back and forth and I'm getting an update on the Israeli strike on Iran, which of course the whole world that knew anything about the whole world was waiting for, not eagerly, but certainly to see what would happen. What was happening according to people on the ground in Tehran and people on the ground in Jordan and in Israel, primarily Tel Aviv, and people reporting on it who have essentially the right attitude about journalism, was that Israel was being defeated. I don't know if it was Russian S-400s or whatever, but I was hearing that what they were doing was not having much impact. Yeah, a few bombs went off, a few things, a few fires and so forth, but nothing of significance. I was even watching a video furnished me by one person who was in Tehran of Iranians out in the street filming with their cell phones. And yet, as the morning went on and I picked up the U.S. news, I saw the usual propaganda. That the attack had come off, that great damage had been done, 100 Israeli planes went out. At the same time, I was picking up some good information from Al Jazeera and others about how badly the Israelis are doing in Lebanon. Frankly, they're getting their rear end handed to them. They're losing more people probably than the IDF at wartime in a tight period has ever lost. Why do I connect these two now? And here's the sad part of my message. I connect them because that is the arena right now, and don't forget Ukraine because it's one of them too, but this is the premier arena right now for someone using a nuclear weapon. Because unlike what I was hoping that Israel would take what it's done and say it's over, and Iran would take what was done to it, which apparently was not all that bad, and say it's over. And this 11 times to the arena lawyer for Bibi Netanyahu, Tony Blinken, would actually succeed in doing something, and maybe we'd have a halt to this. But then as the train pulled into Moynihan, I started getting texts that were quoting what Netanyahu, Yoav Gallant, and some of the others were saying, and quoting what some of the Iranians were saying. And it looks like we're off to the races again, that Iran is going to respond in a spectacular way, and that, of course, Israel will respond to that. This is, to me, an ineluctable chain to an eventual use of a nuclear weapon. If Ukraine is not the Levant the Middle East certainly is. This is a very dire moment because you have this situation that could go off at any second. And I have no doubt that Golda Meir's comment to a BBC reporter in 1972 was accurate when he asked her point blank, if Israel were in existential duress, would it use a nuclear weapon? And she, without batting an eye, said yes. I have no doubt Bibi Netanyahu is a far worse scoundrel than Golda Meir was. So that's the second part of my story. What do we do about that? We need to get out there. We need to do everything we possibly can to let our government know that not only do we want these both of these wars to stop, we definitely don't want a nuclear weapon to be used, and that we will do everything in our power, even though we are operating as Israel's lawyer, to stop that from happening. Thanks.
He calls me by the thunder, the trumpet sounds within my soul.
Moving. And you're welcome to sing along, just don't annoy your neighbor. We have coming up the man who needs no introduction, Jimmy Dore.
Thank you.
I'm not going to lie. It's been a bit of a bummer so far. And a little too much war talk, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know what you guys have against jobs. But anyway, I'll tell you this. I don't know exactly what's happening in Ukraine, but I do know whatever the government and the news media is saying is happening. That's the truth. And sure, they've lied about every war in my lifetime. They lied about Vietnam through four different presidents. They lied about Iraq twice, Afghanistan for 20 years, Libya, Yemen. But when it comes to Ukraine, I just think they're telling the truth this time. It's amazing that we're ending like every empire ends. We overextend militarily while we hollow out our own country and defund it. It was amazing how they sent $113 billion to Ukraine at the just like that. Imagine if they wanted to send $10 billion to America, which would, by the way, pay for community colleges for the whole country. That would take a decade or two. That would require town halls, that would require op-eds. Anderson Cooper would have to put on a t-shirt and interview regular people on the street. $10 billion, that's a lot of money. Do you really want your tax dollars going towards college education? But $113 billion out the door, no discussion, without to the most corrupt country in all of Europe with no oversight at the blink of an eye. That's how you know it's about helping people. I mean, imagine what we could do with that money instead. Imagine what we could do with that money back here in the United States. You know, they say you could end homelessness for $20 billion. So for $100 billion, they could have ended homelessness, then started it again, then said, we were just kidding, and then fucking ended it again. Don't you think for $100 billion they could have taken some of that money and bought a dog that would lead Joe Biden off stage when he's done giving a speech? It's weird. I notice every time we do go to war, it's never for what the American people think it is. And like, for instance, Lindsey Graham just announced a couple of months ago that there's $11 trillion worth of natural resources, minerals, underneath Ukraine. He just blurted it out, like his boyfriend's name on Valentine's Day. And then we find out there's $500 trillion worth of gas and oil in Gaza and off the shore. I'm starting to get a little pattern recognition here, and I wonder when the American people will wake up. Well, hopefully people like Jose and Diane can help them wake up, and events like this and voices like yours will do that. And now we're stuck in, you know, people ask me, they say, Jimmy, what do you think is going to happen with Israel-Palestine? And I say, I think it's going to work itself out. And it's kind of unbelievable. I have friends who are Zionists, and they try to get me to go along with the carpet bombing of Gaza. And they say things like this. They say, Jimmy, I know that you support the LGBTQ community. You know who doesn't, Jimmy? Hamas. Hamas doesn't support gay people. What do you say to that? And I say, I guess we should slaughter their children. Yeah. It's tough jokes for tough times. It's amazing how they try to get you to go along with every war. They have to dehumanize the other people that they want to slaughter, right? Like I remember with the Syrian war, which was the same thing, they would show ISIS and they would show these terrorists with a kitchen knife on TV, and then they would cut their heads off with a kitchen knife, and people are like, oh my God, they're barbarians. You see that? They cut his head off with a kitchen knife. They're barbarians. And I was like, yeah, why don't they, you know, do what we would do and just blow their head off with a nice Christian bomb made by Christians in a nice Christian bomb factory. That's what Jesus would do. It's kind of amazing to see the arguments that people make for supporting a murderous regime and a genocide in Gaza right now. They'll say things like, well, you know, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Yeah. And I'm like, you know why? Because we overthrew all the other fucking democracies so we could steal their oil. Say, I've had people on my show say, well, you know, having Israel as our ally in the Middle East is like having our own aircraft carrier in the Middle East. And I was like, yeah, unfortunately, that aircraft carrier has a concentration camp right in the middle of it. Anyway, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I do want to read to you one of my favorite quotes from Eisenhower. And I have to put on my glasses, I'm old now. And he said, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone, it is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. This is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under the clouds of war, it is humanity hanging on a cross of iron. And he was a bit of a bummer. But those are true statements. And right now, I want to thank you for your time. Thanks for listening. And I want to introduce a fellow who's a true inspiration to me. There is no greater joy that I can experience in this day and age than watching a video of Jose Vega do an intervention on a neoliberal war pig and watching the look on their face. And watching the look on their face when they're confronted by the truth and their own hypocrisy. So I'm going to introduce a man who I refer to as Joe Rogan without a gym membership. The love child of Charo and Michael Tracy's chest hair. Please welcome to the stage, Jose Vega!
Even know what to say to that. It's quite amazing that I could gather so many of my friends in a room to be here to all declare our independence. And I was thinking a lot about how I wanted to start what I have to say. And the first thing I want to do is I want to actually start by giving the biggest thanks to my dad, because my dad has been my number one supporter and biggest fan since I told him maybe about 10 years ago that I was thinking about getting into politics for the first time. I was about 15 years old, and he just said, you know what, son, do what you gotta do. The thing about my dad is that my dad actually recently met Ray McGovern, and he told Ray McGovern something that I didn't even know. I knew my dad was drafted into the Salvadoran Civil War when he was young. I didn't know how young. He told Ray, yeah, I was 14 years old when I was illegally drafted into the Salvadoran Civil War. And so my dad was 14 years old. He was a child soldier, and his job was to go and kill the Contras, which was a U.S.-funded war on both sides. And my dad is just some 14-year-old kid who's caught up in a war that he has no idea about. He's just told he has to go and kill some people because they have different colored uniforms or bandanas and a different flag, and therefore it's his job to go and kill them. And all that changed after my dad left when he was about 16, 17 years old. He had to illegally jump the border. They wouldn't let him through because at the time, they didn't believe that he was actually Salvadorian, because all Salvadorians are fair-skinned. And my dad is my same shade of skin. And so they said, there's no way you're from El Salvador. We're not going to give you refugee status. So he had to come in the country illegally. My dad is an example of people around the world today who are brainwashed when they're young and told that there are people around the world who hate them. Now, thankfully, today my dad is actually a Christian who has done a lot of preaching now, and he preaches for peace, and he admires what I do in trying to call other people to stand up for peace and declare their independence. And so I just want to dedicate what I'm about to say to my dad. That is the one person that I always neglect to thank in everything I do. And what is it that exactly I do and we do? See, people said, oh, people are here coming for you. No, Diane and I are coming for you. You're not coming here for us. We're coming here for you. Because our job is to shock the consciousness and the conscience of Americans and of America. People may remember that when I confronted Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and she looked at me and she was frozen and she didn't really know what to say, and she said, I can't hear you. And it took her 3 to 4 days to respond and say, actually, what they said, it doesn't matter, because they're right-wing Trump supporters. They're part of this weird cult called the LaRouche people. They were going around something about eating babies or something 4 years ago. This is what she said. And yeah, we did do that. But and what we did to her was put her in a kind of crisis of faith in that moment where she knew she was wrong, and every fiber of her being was to stand with us, and she couldn't because she was a sellout. And what we are trying to do here, what we will do here, is we are not just going to do that to all the politicians. We're not just going to do that to our citizens and our fellow citizens. We are doing it to America as a whole, because we were founded on a principle of independence and freedom. We were founded on a principle of declaring our independence from oligarchy, from unjust and prejudice. And we were founded on a principle of freedom. And one of those foundational freedoms was our freedom of speech, to stand up against injustice and lies, and to tell the truth when everyone tells you you are wrong, to look at authority in the face and say you are lying. That is the intervention principle, and it is our job and everybody's job who is listening to call upon the greater angels of your nature and of your country's history. Look at the great figures of history that defined this nation, like Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Abraham Lincoln, President FDR, and President Kennedy. And we are to invoke them into the consciousness of America today to remind people that America is not the British Empire. We are not citizens of Britain. We are not subjects. We are citizens, and with that, there is a responsibility to constantly declare your independence, to constantly fight for nonviolence. But don't get it twisted. Nonviolence is not the absence of war. Nonviolence is perpetual, productive creativity. Nonviolence is building enough housing so that no one has to go without a home at night. No one has to be hungry at night, so that everyone can develop themselves to their fullest capabilities,
to be as creative as possible so that they can leave something behind for the next generations of people to come long after they are dead, long after this earth that we love so much has been swallowed up in a ball by the sun and we are living and spread out amongst galaxies across the cosmos. That's how far we have to think. What do I want a child born in the year 2099, when hopefully I'm in a wheelchair, not dead yet. But what do I want that child's life to look like from the day he is born to the day he is dead? And why do I want it to be infinitely better than anything I could have ever had? And why should I allow that child to make sure that he can make a child born in the year 2199's life infinitely better than his? That is what it means to be a human being, and that is what it means to be an American, but that is also what it means to be a world citizen. And you have to actively declare your independence. So next time you are in a room when someone is lying to you, when someone is telling you that war is peace, you have to stand up, look them in the face, and tell them you are wrong, and you are lying, and we are here to declare our independence.
Hello, my name is Ray McGovern, and I'm speaking to you on behalf of a wonderful young man who is running for Congress. His name is Jose Vega. Now, he comes from the same, he's running in the same district of the Bronx that I grew up in for my first 22 years before I went in the Army. I lived on Bainbridge Avenue near Fordham Road, okay? Jose gives me hope, a sparse commodity these days. Why? Because he's smart, because he knows what he's talking about, and most of all, he's courageous. And for those of you who know a little about virtue, courage is the basis of all virtue. Without courage, all other virtues are specious. So look at his interventions to demonstrate that. Now, I'm proud of having someone that I can look at in the Bronx that represents you all, like the common people. Bainbridge Avenue was pretty middle class and lower class, and we had everybody there, okay? Now it's a very vibrant community, mostly Latino, and it's great, okay? But what I'd say is, we need to have somebody there who's not a creature of some lobby, okay? You got the Israeli lobby. They'll probably try to swift boat Jose in these next 10 days. Don't let them do it, okay? Jose is golden. He gives me hope. I looked up tortoise. You know, I remembered now, Toro, that's the name for bull, and it sort of fits this guy, you know. Add the next part of bull, and you get what diplomats call male bovine excrement, okay? And I looked on Google, and who's to his right? It was unbelievable. Who's to his right? Rudy Giuliani, Nikki Haley. So these are the people that associate with tortoise. Simply, let me say this. With Jose, you won't have anybody winking or keeping his mouth shut about genocide. My God. Genocide that we are not only permitting but enabling with our arms deliveries to Richie Tortoise's patrons, the Israel lobby, okay? So with these wars going on in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Hezbollah territory, and in Ukraine, remember, folks, Julian Assange, a good friend of mine, warned 20 years ago that if wars can be started by lies, they can be ended by truth. And that's what Jose will bring to Congress. The truth, and the truth will set us free. Vota para Jose. Vote for Jose. Thanks for listening.
So first, I want to say that since I didn't get to introduce Jose, I wanted to congratulate you, Jose, for doing an excellent job on your campaign. It's been a weird one. We're here. And the reason that's significant is because we are not in jail, although one person in the chorus is headed off there on Tuesday. And although our nation has been going fascist really since the death of FDR, after the Kennedy assassination, the jailing of Lyndon LaRouche, and the aftermath of 9/11 and probably the pre-math into 9/11, with an accelerating escalation of censorship under the Biden-Harris War Administration, we still have enough freedom to change the direction of our nation if we use it. That's why we organized this event. A few years ago, I was telling Jose that my dream was that in the city of New York, no one should be able to come here and tell lies in public. That's happened to some people, but we need more people. This should be a city where people know that when they come, they're not going to be able to lie to the population because someone is going to get up and pull a Jose Vega. So it's not enough, because our government at this moment, and I know many people share my frustration, we know we're out there organizing. The majority of the American people do not support war. The majority of the American people do not support genocide. So why is this happening? It's happening because we haven't stopped our government from doing it. According to our Declaration of Independence, we're obligated to stop the government. It says right in there that if the government has become abusive of these ends, that is, that every human being is created equal and endowed with inalienable rights, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. If our government becomes abusive of these ends, it is our right and our duty to alter or abolish it. That's what we're supposed to do as American citizens. How do we do that? Not through violence. That won't work, because in the United States, the culture is important. You could overthrow a government in violence. You could vote them out. We could vote out the Harris-Biden administration. But what guarantees that what comes next will be any better unless the population itself changes? That is, we have to be enlightened enough and good enough and love mankind enough to have the wisdom not only to choose good leaders, but to be good leaders. That's why we're here. And that's why the music is such a big part of this program. It is not going to help us to dump Dick Cheney if we are not good enough to make our government uphold the principles of justice and human dignity. Now, as Helga mentioned earlier, 4 days ago, 57% of the world's population was meeting in Kazan. Isn't that something? It's not on the front page of the New York Times. It's not in the news. But who are we? We're 4% of the world's population. And the nations that have now joined, I'm going to read off so you can consider what this means as partners of the BRICS. Brazil, we have those are the five. The new partners, Indonesia, Nigeria, Vietnam, Turkey, Thailand, Uganda, Algeria, Uzbekistan, Malaysia, Kazakhstan, Bolivia, Cuba, Belarus. That's more than 1 billion people who have just become associated with the BRICS. Someone said that the leader of Turkey, Erdogan, is probably the only person in the world who could figure out how to be in BRICS and NATO at the same time. So the musical selections that are going to come up now, we're going to have a tour of the world, and it's designed really to reflect the choral principle, where the chorus, and they will tell you, and when we were in COVID and we had to listen to everyone singing individually, I will tell you, everyone is very individual. And I will tell you that, no offense to the chorus or myself, I'm there with you, every voice in our non-audition amateur chorus is not an operatic superstar. But somehow, when we bring this chorus together, and each of them contributes their own unique talent on their own separate part, you produce something which is greater than the parts. The whole is greater than the parts. And what we're going to hear in the upcoming musical selections is some music from all over the world, and you can reflect on how much we have to gain and to benefit from collaborating with each other, and why the world should be much more like a chorus and not a cacophony and not a nuclear war. We're going to hear some compositions by Dvorak, who came here to the United States on the mission to create a great and noble school of classical music. And he said that the music of the Native American population and the African American population was the seed crystal for everything that we needed to have our own classical culture in the United States. And that began and it took root, but we had a very ugly shift with Jim Crow. He left and we didn't get to complete the development of the American conservatory and tradition of classical music, but you will find relics of it. So we're now approaching the 250th anniversary of the founding of our republic. And I think it's a question whether we are going to continue as a republic, and that's up to us. And I wanted to share with you some words from our first president, George Washington, in his farewell address, and you might consider their relevance in the situation we face today. He said, "The nation which indulges toward another an habitual hatred or an habitual fondness is in some degree a slave. It is a slave to its animosity or to its affection, either of which is sufficient to lead it astray from its duty and its interest." So let us stop being slaves.
من شاهد غم بودم در فصل زوال گل، من مردن نرگس را دیدم ز پی سنبول. من مرگ شقایق را در دامن کهساران دیدم دم که چه خونین بود در ماتم یک باران. دهکده ها امروز سوگ همه گل هاست، سر تا سر صحراها در تیرگی شب هاست. پس صبح فریبا کو تنهای و خاموشی با رنگ سیاه خود و سرد فراموشی. ای دوست بیا دستان مرا بفشا تا بار دگر با هم گلهای سبد ها را راه دیگه دست آمان در دهکده می کاریم. گلهای بهاران را اندوه زمستانی پوشانده در این صحرا، ای دوست بیا دیر است دستان مرا بفشا تا بار دگر با هم گلهای سبزها را آهدی دستامان در دهکده می‌کاریم.
Hello, my name is Lena Malki, I'm Swedish, and I will sing two songs for you. I will sing a first song that is Swedish, that is called Värmlandsvisan. It's the song about this region, Värmland, that even if I go to the promised land, I will always want to come back to Värmland. And then the second song is a Finnish song, Taivas on sininen ja valkoinen, and that means that the sky is blue and white and full of stars. And the same thing is the young heart, also with sorrows of love.
Kommer jag en bit i ditt förråd. This is Itemba Mgwaya all the way in South Africa and Cape Town. We would love to promote love and peace with the song we're about to do, which is Wotando, which means love will conquer all. Thank you.
We have been, and first of all, I want to again emphasize the international audience that's watching. Thank you. I'm sure it's probably really late in some countries like China, which happens to be about 12 hours ahead of us. So for those who are watching in those countries who are staying up late, thank you. This is a message of greetings from Dr. Tor and Mohammed Salim Akhtar. Mohammed Salim Akhtar is the National Director of the American Muslim Alliance, and Dr. Mohammed Ashraf Tor, President of the Pakistan-American Democratic Forum, issued a joint statement of greetings. We honor and express our support for the peace rally and thank the organizers. The Sayre and Vega election campaigns for U.S. Senate and Congress. As acknowledged by the World Jury, the International Criminal Court, and the majority of countries, and also echoed by many, including Mian Shahbaz Sharif, Prime Minister of Pakistan, then that the apartheid state of Israel has committed crimes against humanity, genocide of Palestinians in occupied Palestine. It's deplorable that the United States has been complicit by providing billions of dollars of arms to the killing machine of Israel, despite millions of citizens who have been protesting and opposing the administration and been demanding peace initiatives. We demand the equitable, peaceful, and just resolution to all the conflicts and political, social, economic, and military aggressions anywhere, including Palestine and Ukraine. This is why we support the establishment of a new security and development architecture for the whole world.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, please do not mind the chorus as they take their back for their final performances. I have another message to be read. This is a message from Steve Leeper. This is the chairman of the Peace Culture Village in Hiroshima, the co-founder of the Peace Education Art Communication Institute. He is the coordinator in Atlanta, Georgia for the Hub of Back from the Brink, former chairman of the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation, Secretariat of Mayors for Peace, and I'm pretty sure he was also just nominated, if not won a Nobel Peace Prize. Could be wrong on that. But he says, message sent with regret to Diane Sayre, Jose Vega, and everyone else at the Build a Peace Chorus Against the Ghouls of War program in New York City. Thank you. Wish I were there. You are building peace at a time when the ghouls of war appear in complete control, and I, as a Hiroshimian, am grateful. A few days ago, as I was absorbing my daily dose of horror and rage, a cheerful vision lifted me from my routine despair. It occurred to me that Ukraine and Palestine, among many other ghoulish atrocities, are the darkest hour that comes just before dawn. The Israelis in particular have ripped the mask off. The culture of war stands exposed for the selfish, cruel, and absurdly self-destructive mindset it inherently is. Perhaps because the dawn is near, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee suddenly found, 50 years late, the courage to ignore the nuclear industry. My love and respect for thus far unsung and even now vastly underappreciated Nihon Hidanko greatly exceeds the limits of this brief message. I am simply grateful that even the Nobel Committee has seen fit to express its preference for human survival. Humanity is attempting to evolve from caterpillar to butterfly. The caterpillar is fighting desperately to keep that from happening, and the butterfly cells are still too few and too little united. All of us few who, like the Nobel Committee, would prefer to keep this planet habitable, must now bring our respective lights together to focus like a giant global laser on the prevention of nuclear war. Everything else depends on success in this endeavor. If every segment of our peace culture can rally effectively around the anti-war nuclear flag, we will crack the chrysalis and start squirming to the next level. If the caterpillar wins, humanity will join the dinosaurs with no one to blame but our own selfish, competitive selves. Steve Leeper.
Assalamu alaikum. Hello, and peace be upon you. My name is Yafa, and I am a Palestinian. Just as our poet Mahmoud Darwish said, we Palestinians are sick. We suffer from an incurable disease called hope. Hope for liberation and independence. Hope for a normal life. Hope to see our children go to school without danger. Hope for a pregnant woman to give birth to a living child in a hospital and not in front of a military checkpoint. Hope that our poets will see beauty of the color red in roses and not in blood. Hope that this land will finally find peace. To continue on this path of hope, and in November 1st, 2023, Rifat Al-Arir, a Palestinian writer, poet, and a university professor, shared his poem titled, If I Must Die. If I must die, you must live. To tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings, make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who lived in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to him, to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment, an angel is here, bring back love. If I must die, let it bring hope, let it be a sail. On December the 6th, 2023, and in Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza, Rifat Al-Arir was murdered in an Israeli airstrike, along with his brother, sister, and their children. Rifat Al-Arir died. Let it bring hope. Let it be a tale. Thank you for carrying this banner of hope with us. And remember, Abraham Lincoln said, the U.S. could not stay divided, half free and half slave. It's time for our freedom. And just as Nelson Mandela said, our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of Palestinians. Thank you.
Shalom.
please sing in the refrain?
Yes, we'll rally round the flag, boys, we'll rally once again.
Shouting the battle cry of freedom.
We will rally from the hillsides, we'll gather from the plain.
Shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever, hurrah, boys, hurrah. Down with the traitor, up with the star. While we rally round the flag, boys, rally once again.
Springing to the call of our brothers gone before.
Shouting the battle cry of freedom.
And we'll fill the vacant ranks with a million free men more.
Shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever. Hurrah, boys, hurrah. Down with the traitor, up with the star. While we rally round the flag, boys, rally once again.
Welcome to our numbers, the loyal, true, and brave.
Shouting the battle cry of freedom.
And although they may be poor, not a man shall be a slave.
Shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever. Hurrah, boys, hurrah. Down with the traitor, up with the star. While we rally round the flag, boys, rally once again.
So we're springing to the call from the east and from the west.
Shouting the battle cry of freedom.
And we'll hurl the rebel crew from the land we love the best.
Shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever. Hurrah, boys, hurrah. Down with the traitor. Up with the star. While we rally round the flag, boys, rally once again.
Well, this is the conclusion of our program. First, I want to thank everybody who made it out in New York City this fine Saturday. I want to thank our international audience, of course, for tuning in, being a part of our international process. And I want to thank everybody who's supported us from the very beginning. Thank you all so much for coming here. Thank you for being as supportive and enthusiastic about our campaigns as you've always been. It's kept us going. And thank you. That's all.
Wait. We wanted to end the live stream, and we have to tell you what.